Hello out there, podcast listeners. Welcome. We are at the Taste of Chicago, and welcome to Talk Sports. This is our adventures in the art of lively conversation. I'm your host, Gary Zabinski, and I'm joined today by my usual sidekick from DeKalb, Illinois, my good friend Roscoe. How are you, Roscoe?
I am terrific, and I'm well fed. I've been eating all afternoon.
You have been. We've walked miles and miles, and this shirt was an extra small when we started out, I think.
Yes, and now it's grown in size, as have I.
And you've had everything here at Taste that has lobster in the title, I believe.
Yes, at lobster, shrimp, corn dogs, fudge.
Lobster pizza.
Lobster pizza.
You've had just about anything. Listen, we're coming to you today, live and direct, from the Food for Thought stage at this year's 35th annual Taste of Chicago, on the corner of Jackson and Columbus in the heart of Chicago's Grant Park. And we are thrilled and honored to be here in this inaugural attempt at featuring podcasts at Taste. What a beautiful, I say that in quotation marks, day. It's hardly July weather, don't you think, Roscoe?
It's a beautiful day for October.
We've been doing podcasts now for May, June, part of April. It feels like the weather's always the same.
It's always
every
the same.
I'm shivering here. I may have to put my mittens on. And even the crowd is all dressed up in their spring coat finest, or fall jacket finest, I think. Yes, all of them are wearing as much clothing as possible, and it's drizzling. Also joining us today is our very special guest, Jeff Award-winning and Chicago theater scene actor, Southside native, and food industry veteran, if I might call you that, the amazingly talented, my friend, Larry Newman Jr. Welcome, Larry.
Hey, guys. It's great to be here at the Taste.
You didn't bring any of your Jeff Awards with you, did you?
No, I don't have enough room.
How many Jeff Awards have you won, Larry?
I think I have three.
You think you have three? You don't know?
Well, I have three for sure, and then there's other pieces of paper.
You've got awards for ensemble acting.
Yeah, I don't get those.
For a company, but you don't get a piece of
you don't get a piece of the star.
Or
the
a statuette,
star.
Or
no,
you don't
no.
get to
All
make
All you get is the individual. When you win individually, then you get to keep it.
They hand you something.
Yeah, if you're an ensemble one, or like the show wins an award, then the theater keeps it.
Should we throw in, if you don't know, that the Jeff Awards are the Oscars of Chicago theater?
Yeah, you could throw that in.
Well, we'll throw that in.
The Tonys of Chicago theater.
Let's
be
theater.
Fair. I mean,
yeah,
it's just
true.
One
It's the Stanley Cup of Chicago theater.
Okay, very good. I'll take that.
And like the Blackhawks, you have won three times in recent years.
Yeah, that's right.
That's exciting.
Now, we're called Talk Sports. We don't necessarily talk sports all that much. We are involved in the sport of talking and conversation. But occasionally we'll throw in something of a sports reference. You heard the Blackhawks here to my left. I just got to do a big shout out to the women's U.S. soccer team winning the World Cup last weekend. Either of you watched that game?
Yes, indeed. That was quite exciting.
Wasn't it fantastic?
It was.
These athletes are absolutely fantastic, world-class, and a thrill to watch.
Yeah.
I believe there was a ticker tape parade in Lower Manhattan today for the
team. Yes, indeed.
I can't wait for the Olympics. Those girls,
ladies,
look fantastic, and I can't wait to watch them again. It's going to be terrific. Those of you here, how many of you have been to Taste of Chicago before? Yeah, a few of you have been to Taste of Chicago before. I haven't been to the Taste of Chicago in, dare I say, 20 years. How about you, Larry?
That sounds about right. When it used to be at the pier, and I think I went once or twice when it was here.
Roscoe, have you been to the Taste in recent memory?
I have not been in recent years, but I've been coming to the Taste of Chicago back when it was Chicago Fest, and the headline entertainer one afternoon was Frank Sinatra. In the afternoon. He landed at Migs Field. They put him on a helicopter. He landed practically on the stage, got off the helicopter, sang for an hour, got back on the helicopter, and flew back to California.
What a fantastic day that was.
It was thrilling.
They don't often have that kind of entertainment here anymore.
No, sadly.
Frank Sinatra. Well, you know, Taste of Chicago is the world's largest food festival. The event is the largest festival in Chicago, of course. Non-food related events include live music on multiple stages, including Petrillo Music Show, which if you turn around, you can see it right through the trees back there. And there's a show that's about to start. There's pavilions. There's film performances. A little bit of history. Arnie Morton is the creator of the event. He decided to line up Chicago restaurants to participate and persuaded then-Chicago Mayor Jane Byrne. Any of you remember Jane Byrne?
Of course. She just passed away within the last year.
She did, in fact. And Commissioner of Cultural Affairs Lois Weisberg to block off Michigan Avenue for the very first Taste of Chicago on the 4th of July, 1980. And of the 100,000 people that the organizers expected to show up, over 250,000 people showed up with food and soda sales grossing only $300,000. But this was a one-day event at its inception. The next year, the Taste was moved to Grand Park and grew in size and scope of becoming a 10-day event with more food vendors and music performers. And it also became the world's largest food festival that year. Chicago Fest, started by Mayor Michael Blandick, was the precursor to the Taste of Chicago. And Jane Byrne attempted to end the festival as well as many other programs associated with the former mayor, slowly phasing Chicago Fest out in the process as she put her powers behind.
Why is that?
Doing Taste
of
Chicago.
Was it to save money, or why did she want to end Chicago Fest?
Well, I think that she felt that the Taste of Chicago was more in keeping with bringing Chicago entities and food together and really making a statement about what Chicago is. Taste of Chicago, City Fest in Detroit, those are just a couple of the large food festivals in the country. Taste of Champagne. The Taste of Danforth in Toronto. The Taste of Kalamazoo.
What would that be?
I had a Taste of Kalamazoo once.
That's all you need.
Oh, no, that's a gallon Kalamazoo, not that. Taste of Addison, Taste of Denver, Taste in Dallas, Taste of Madison, Taste of Austin, Taste of Peoria, Illinois. You're both salivating. I can see the drool coming out of both sides of your mouth. And The Bite in Portland, Oregon. Just to name a few.
I like that, The Bite.
And the first Taste of Festival was, do you know where the first Taste of Festival was? I'll give you a hint. It was in 1979.
Wasn't it here in Chicago?
It was not. Cincinnati.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought we invented this.
Coined the term Taste of Festival. In 2005, the Taste attracted about 3.9 million people with over 70 food vendors and $12.33 million in revenue. The event eventually was shortened to 5 days, as it is now. In 2013, the Taste of Chicago turned a profit for the first time in 6 years with profit sales totaling $272,000. That was a good year. The various performers they've had over the years, well, the list is extensive. The Black Crows, Charlie Wilson and the Gap Band, the Jayhawks, Loretta Lynn has been here. Yeah, wow. Yonder Mountain String Band, Glenn Campbell has played here. Clint Black, Broadway in Chicago has done presentations on the stages.
Do you know what my favorite performer was?
Frank Sinatra.
Here? No. I was here 1 year and they did an entire afternoon of 50s and 60s music. And the headliners were Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon. And it was unbelievable to see the a musketeer live on stage. I was thrilled.
What did they sing? What did they do? Beach Bucket Bingo?
She sang La Bamba and some songs from her movies, and she sang an original song about what it was like as an 11-year-old girl to drive across country with her family to try to make it in the movies, which she did.
Isn't that sort of a biographical story of your life?
Yes, but I never made it in the movies. Larry Newman Jr., however, has made it in the movies. That's a segue. And have an audition tomorrow.
Yeah, and that's the life of an actor. It's like the day before you get the call that you're supposed to be somewhere at 2:30 and you're supposed to be ready and, you know, assume a character and boom, there you go.
Right.
Yeah. So
and here you are.
While we were here eating, I was having a puff of doom. And I got this email. You have to be ready tomorrow.
So what do you have to do now to prepare for that? Do you have to grow a beard? Do you have to put on a limp or something? What?
Well, I have to read the character and see what he's like.
Do you have the sides?
They're on my phone. That's one of the great... we were kind of chatting about how the devices that we have are anathema today. But then they're also very convenient because now they can send me the whole script in an email. And before I would have to run down to the agent, pick up the script, run back home, da-da-da. It's all beautifully there right in the phone as long as it can, you know... get your charge.
So after this podcast, you're going to go home, you're going to take your phone, you're going to look at the side, you're going to read it, mm-hmm. and you're going to study the characters so that you can properly audition for them tomorrow.
Yeah.
Where do you have to go for this audition?
It's Pascal and Nikki. They're down at Hubbard. So
what is that, an agency?
Yeah, a casting agent. Yeah.
Oh.
There's about three or four in town that mostly handle most of the stuff that comes through.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
I can't wait. Is it a big blockbuster super film?
Or? No, it's like an indie thing, but it's going to be shot here in Chicago. It's called Olympia. And the woman who's doing Olympia actually got a scholarship, but some kind of fellowship award. So she's using the money to produce this film. So that's kind of cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that.
Thanks.
Now, before and during your long and tenured theater career, you also had
tenuous right now.
I didn't want to go there. Before that, and during that, you had a bout with the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
So you fit right in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You and your father used to run a beef stand called...
It was called Jay's Where Beef is King.
Jay's Where Beef is King.
And it certainly was. And we did cheese, pepper, and eggs, and hot dogs. You know, the typical... South Side.
And it was like under the skyway.
It was under the skyway. Right? 9409 South Commercial, which is literally under the skyway.
If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know about it. You couldn't possibly find it.
You had to know about
it. Even GPS does not have it listed.
It was not there.
And Jay's Where Beef is King put you through college.
Yeah, pretty much.
What's happening there now?
It's a tire store.
Are they still using the same product to make the tires?
Don't tell Vienna Beef.
Because I had a Vienna Beef sandwich there once. Well, did you ever buy to come into taste in the old days?
When it first started, every small restaurant in all the neighborhoods, I mean, that was one of the great things, was that you had this chance to come downtown and have all your food tried by everyone in the city. And that was a big thing. So, and you had to fill out there was a tremendous amount of paperwork, and you also had to have the backing of your alderman.
Yeah, weren't there political connections involved in trying to get a booth at Taste of Chicago in the early days? I'm back to the politics again.
You're back to the politics.
Well, and
making
me
nervous.
We had Eddie Verdoliak back then, so that was a pretty good, you know, inside, but it didn't work.
And so you never got
in. No, we never got in, so we were kind of upset about it, but...
Well, we wandered around Taste earlier today for a couple of hours, trying to sample as much fare as we could and taking in the atmosphere. It's a little bit of a gray day. It's very, as I mentioned earlier, it's cool here. It's well in the lower 60s, people in jackets and not a lot of hustle, bustle, sweatiness going on out there, I would say. But we tried a couple of things. Roscoe, you tried a bunch of stuff that we talked about. What did you enjoy most?
Well, there were a couple of things. I was very excited that the Spam Company is giving out free samples of Spam, which was really thrilling to me. And there were a couple of... you talked about little neighborhood places that are here. They're still here. And there are restaurants and cafes that I've never been to. I was most excited about Beaver's Coffee and Donuts, mostly because I liked the name.
I love that name.
And there are also a lot of non-food vendors here. The Revlon company is here providing makeovers.
Let me go back to the Spam thing. Larry and I, we actually tried the Spam.
And?
We stood in line. What did we have? They had Spam fries.
They had Spam fries, who a lovely person who was with us tried, and she gave them to both of us, I believe.
She gave them away. Let's be blunt. She gave them away. They were not to her liking.
Yeah.
What else? They had a little spam sandwich, like the Cubana.
The Spambano. Spambano.
Right. And then I had what looked like a spam piece of sushi. It was a slice of spam surrounded by a hunk of white rice and wrapped with seaweed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it tasted a little bit like eel. You know, that cooked eel. Yeah. I could have eaten those. Some guy in front of us said, oh, yeah, they sell these on golf courses out in the West and in Hawaii, he said.
Yeah.
And they're usually about as big as an actual real sandwich.
And we also learned from this gentleman that Hawaii is the spam capital of the United States. I mean, they just eat it up there with a passion.
He told us this, and we still can't figure that out, Roscoe, why the island of Hawaii is the spam capital of the world.
I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, everything's very expensive in Hawaii. Maybe spam is affordable.
Well, it comes in a can.
And
you can ship it just about anywhere.
Easy to ship. It has a shelf life of about 25 years, so you can keep it in your pantry forever.
Even in your stomach.
You know what I like? One of the original idea with Taste of Chicago is you got a taste of different things. So you weren't buying an entree. Over the years, people started selling larger and larger portions,
right?
And that presents some challenges. And so I noticed a bunch of vendors are back to that original concept that you can either get an entree or you can spend $5 and get a small taste.
Yeah, tickets. It's a good, economically, it's a brilliant idea, and it's a really, I think it's a great thing. I don't know if they've done this in the last recent years, but if they haven't, and this is the first year of going back to that, just a little taste, I think it's a fantastic idea.
Right.
For really like four or five tickets, you can get you know, a good assortment of what this vendor has to offer.
Yeah, but just before we started this, we were sitting next to a couple and they were eating. My favorite item that they sell here is an entire turkey leg. It looked like something on the Flintstones. I mean, you buy it, if you come to Taste of Chicago, buy a turkey leg, eat the turkey leg, you're basically done.
And it was so romantic because they were sharing it.
Yes.
Get passing it back and forth to take another hunk off. It actually looked pretty darn good.
It did.
And it looked like a good date night that they were having.
A wonderful date night.
And a cheap date night. What else did you have, Larry, that was
Well, I did mention the Puffs of Doom.
Yeah, you had that.
Puffs of Doom.
You had that bacon macaroni.
And it was a bacon macaroni cheese thing on a little puff pastry, and it was quite tasty.
I tried a bit of that. Yeah. It was very rich.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Pretty darn rich.
That was the savory Puff of Doom. They also had sweet Puffs of Doom.
We love
which
that.
Which I thought we were in Colorado for a minute when they.
My other favorite was Punky's Pizza is here, and they made an unusual choice that Punky's Pizza is not selling pizza. So you can get anything else, Italian that they serve, but not pizza.
Italian sausage sandwich.
Mastaccioli, little pieces of lasagna, no pizza.
No pizza.
I'm a little bitter about that.
Well, it didn't have a very long line at it as well, so I think that people got the idea that no pizza, why should I stand here? I suspect they're going to do very well in the next coming days. Today just didn't seem to have.
Well, you know, what's great about this, world's largest food festival, it's not terribly crowded. I mean, there are a lot of people here, but this is a gigantic park and a lot of room for people, so I've never felt encroached upon. Or the lines have not been terrible, and it seems like everyone's having a great time.
I think the most popular booths we saw out there were booths that were serving things like jerk chicken and Jamaican specialties. Why those were going over so well, I'm not exactly sure, but you could see them actually making them out back. They have these huge grills, and they're smoky, and you know that chicken's coming hot off the coals. Those had the longest lines by far of any vendors out there.
One of my theories is that long lines draw long lines. If you see a lot of people standing in line, you think, oh my God, this must be good. I'm going to stand in line too.
That's in the theater as well.
Yes, it is in the theater as well. You know, they had something out there called a cooling tent?
Yes, it was the Pepsi cooling tent. and they didn't have the air conditioning. It was to go in on a hot day to cool down, but it's already cold.
I believe people were going in to warm up.
So it should have been a Pepsi warming tent. And I said to the man, what are you doing here? And he said, well, it's not very warm, so we don't have the air conditioning on, but if you just want to come in and sit on the couch and hang out for a while, you can.
They had doormen out front like it was some sort of private club, and I thought, something cool must be going on in here. And they said, excuse us, where are you going, sir? I'm like, well, we just want to see what it is. Well, we have no air conditioning today. Or misters.
Or misters.
We don't want that. Do you have any, like, bearskin rugs that we can roll up?
I should also point out, and we are, it's been a very wet June. It's now July. But it's been a very wet summer, and it's very swampy here, which, you know, there's nothing the city can do about that. I'm a little worried about getting malaria because there's a lot of mosquitoes swirling around my head at the moment.
We're in a bit of a low spot in Grant Park, a little swampy here. If it rains in any appreciable way, Katie bar the door, because we will be washed away. I think some of my favorite places out there, vendor-wise, were the Fat Shallot, which was serving grilled cheese with Munster, caramelized onions, and salted spinach. I didn't get a chance to get in line for that. It was very, very long. Vivi's African Restaurant, they were serving sautéed goat and plantains.
Oh, dear.
We had a goat experience recently.
I had a very unhappy goat experience recently.
And red beans and rice with, there you go, jerk chicken. And it was very popular. Bruges Brothers was having a Papas Bravas braised in oxtail poutine, duck fat frites, and sauce. Mm. Very unusual. And Garifuna Flava, a taste of Belize. We don't get Belizean cuisine every day, everywhere. And they were having panadas, jerk chicken again with rice and beans, plantains, fried ripe plantains. A very popular booth, Hare's Gulf Shrimp. You had some shrimp today. You had a shrimp roll.
I had a little $5 piece of shrimp roll, and it was delicious.
By far, I think the largest line was at a place called Iyanza. Iyanze, jerk chicken with rice and beans and plantains. This is where they had the most smoky barbecues going on around back. Caramelized spiky jerk wings and vegetarian spinach and plantains. The other one that I thought was doing gangbuster business, and I actually got something from them, the Jinju Restaurant. They were serving, it was a bit like Thai food.
Yeah.
I had something called a bulgogi, which was chopped and fried prime rib beef, and then it was sautéed with onions and carrots and ginger. Absolutely delicious.
Yeah, you wouldn't even give me a taste.
Well, I was still eating when you looked at my bowl and you said, are you going to finish that? And I said, yes, I'm going to finish that. This was after you had already had a giant bowl of something yourself. I think you'd had a lobster.
But that lobster, it was unlike any lobster I've ever seen in my life.
It was a special name for it, I think, the slipper.
The slipper. Yeah, it was a very small lobster tail, but it might have been
a slipper lobster.
Lobster. It's like an overgrown crayfish.
Very much so, and curled up like an old shoe.
Yes,
I think. How about the Sensodyne toothpaste dental hygiene booth? That was right next door to the spam truck.
I think I'm going to eat some spam, and then I'm going to go next door. They were offering free dental screenings at the sense of like, I'm going to go to Taste of Chicago, and now I'm going to worry about my teeth. But they gave you free toothpaste if you stood in line long enough, so that was...
Whole batches of toothpaste.
That was kind of exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
But you got a free dental, you know, checkup if you needed it.
There's a lot of people without dental coverage that could use a free dental checkup, especially after eating spam.
Sure.
Why not? You know what I think they should have here, though? It's not really with taste, but neither is the cooling tent. It doesn't go with the theme, but they should have maybe a massage tent. What you think after having a bunch of samples of food and a couple of puffs of doom pastries, you could use a good shoulder massage, maybe even like a chair massage tent.
Or the feet, you know, you're walking.
You like a good massage.
I love a good massage.
You've been to Chinese massage therapists.
Yes.
And maybe we should have a Chinese massage therapist.
Yes, they walk on my back.
Tell me about that last massage you had.
Well, it was, she almost broke every bone in my body. I go to this place in New York City. It's in the Village. It's Chinese massage, and it's a whopping $46 an hour.
Wow.
And it's very inexpensive, and these the women who work there just beat the hell out of me.
Do they actually walk on your back and put their knees in your...
It's even worse. They will, if they find a knot in your back or anywhere, they will work on it until it goes away or until you beg them to please stop. And the grand finale of this massage the last time is I'm on my stomach, she climbs on top of me and digs her knees into my back and then walks with her knees from my waist up to my shoulders and then had my turned around and sort of gripped my head between her knees so that she could then work on the other half of my body, and it was a bit horrifying. and I my mother turned 92 last week, and I was telling her about this, so simply from a health and well-being point of view. And she said, Ross, do you ever get into any situations with those women at the massage places?
What did she mean, situations?
Like she's 92. Like, I don't want my mother thinking
like
about things
wink,
like
wink?
That. Like, wink, wink, exactly.
Happy ending.
Yes. Like, mother, for the love of God. You know, my mother's a 92-year-old minister's widow in Sandwich, Illinois, and she's worried about me getting into trouble at a Chinese massage parlor in the Greenwich Village.
And what did you say?
I said, no, mother. No, mother. Nothing happens. You know, I practically wear Mormon underwear when I go there because I'm so nervous about what will ensue. So I got away safely.
I'm going to start calling you Norman Bates from now on. You talk to your mother just like he did in the movie.
Oh, that's a little frightening.
No, mother.
No, mother.
I haven't been seeing other women. You mentioned New York. And you were in New York recently.
I was in, yes.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about theater experiences that we've had since we have our lovely guest, Larry Newman Jr. here. You were in New York recently. What did you see?
This is a crazy story.
Yeah.
I love this story.
Okay.
I'm in New York. Every time I fly to New York, my flight is delayed. It's just a rule. If I'm going to fly anywhere, I must sit at O'Hare for 4 hours. So I'm getting there. I have a business reason for being there the next day. My flight's to leave at 2. It doesn't leave until 4:30 in the afternoon. We land at LaGuardia at 7:30. In fact, I'm not going to be able to see a play tonight because you can't physically get from LaGuardia to Midtown Manhattan in 20 or 30 minutes. So I hop into a cab. The cab driver says, where are you going? And I said, well, I'm either going to a Chinese massage parlor, but if you think you can get me to Broadway, because that's how we say it in New York, Broadway, if you think you can get me there in 20 minutes, get me there. But I don't think you can. He said, I'll get you there. So I...
Challenge.
This is unbelievable. I get in the cab at 7:39. At 8:01, I exit the cab at the American Airlines Theater, run into the theater. I said, you still have a ticket for tonight. It was on the 20th Century. Uh-huh. Kristen Chenoweth and Peter Gallagher. He had a ticket in the front row.
For God's sake.
Absolutely. I buy a ticket in the front row. I run in. I said, you have a check room? And the guy goes, yeah, I'll just take it. Run into the theater. I run to the theater, sit down. The curtain comes up. It was unbelievable.
They knew who you were.
And that I could get, you know, it'd be like getting from O'Hare to downtown Chicago in 15 minutes. It was impossible. And it was a great show. Wonderful show. It's a show that isn't produced very often. Mm-hmm. I would say it's A-minus production of a B-minus script.
Oh, I think it's better than a B-minus script.
Have you seen it?
I saw the original production.
With Madeline Kahn?
Yeah, and I would say it was a B-plus script. By far.
Yeah, I will really, say... I laughed
till I peed.
it was very funny. It was very entertaining. One thing that unfortunately happened is that my ears popped on the airplane, and they didn't unpop. So even though I was sitting in the front row, I felt as if I had, you know, something stuffed in my ears, and I got a little carried away with thinking, "Boy, that Kristen Chenoweth is beautiful. She has everything. Mm. She's funny. She's got a great body, beautiful face, blue eyes, blonde hair, red lips. She's the whole package. She's great." I was carried away by how talented she is. Peter Gallagher is 60 years old and has a head of hair like you've never seen in your life. He also has blue eyes, great mouth, great teeth, And I'm thinking about how beautiful they are and how stunning they are and how talented they are. And then I realized I was so carried away by this that I hadn't listened to anything that happened in the show for 15 minutes. And I got completely lost and had no idea what was happening.
This is why I never sit in the front row, because I get distracted by all of the glamour and glitz and people's pores and their nose jobs.
Nose hairs.
Exactly. Yes. They look fantastic. And I just... 20 minutes goes by and I go, wait a minute, what's the plot here?
What's happening?
Why is Bugs Bunny wearing a dress? I don't understand. I don't remember. Speaking of theatrical events, I did want to mention that for all of our podcast listeners here in attendance, that this weekend, Friday and Saturday, the Grant Park Music Festival is doing their Sondheim celebration. I say their Sondheim celebration. They do one about every 9 years or something like that. And this one happens to be this Friday evening and Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. They have brought in Stephen Sondheim's longtime collaborator, music director, and conductor, Paul Gemignani, to put the program together, and a couple of very talented singers and a combo of musicians who are all playing out in front of the full Grant Park Orchestra. I was at rehearsal yesterday, and it sounds just fantastic. If you're a fan of the theater in any way, especially if you're a Sondheim fan, you owe it to yourself to get yourself down to the Pritzker Pavilion. Which is, and the show's at 8 o'clock because of taste. They have performances here on the Petrillo stage from 5:30 to 7 or 7:30. So when those are over, then they
because
start.
Of the sound bleed.
Because of the sound bleed.
The last time, when was the last Sondheim show? 10 years ago?
2006, yeah.
2009 years ago. If that park holds 11,000 people, 14,000 people were there.
Without question, they were hanging off the walls. They were sitting on the walls. You couldn't find a space to breathe in there.
It was beyond thrilling.
Yeah, and they didn't even have someone of Paul Gemignani's background and pedigree. He's quite something. He's been a musical director for all Sondheim shows and projects since Follies.
Wow.
Every single
wow.
one. That's quite a reputation. I met him yesterday. He's a marvelously nice man, and the band sounded really, really good.
Follies is a musical by Stephen Sondheim, 1971, which was about a bunch of old showgirls showing up for a reunion, and they're about to tear down the theater in which they've appeared as showgirls during World War II. It's 30 years later, and they're examining the folly of their lives, and it's a chance for a lot of... Yeah, Gary is rolling his eyes, which you can't tell because we're not on television.
It's good for podcasting, eye rolling.
Yes, eye rolling always works. And anyway, it's a legendary musical. I'm still here. A lot of great songs in it. Mm. So I just sort of love that and the reason I mention this is I was at breakfast the other day and was reading the newspaper about the Sondheim concert coming up. And the waiter said, "What are you reading about?" And I said, "I'm reading about the Stephen Sondheim concert." And he said, "Who's Stephen Sondheim?"
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I said, "Oh, you're kidding." Well, he wasn't kidding. So you know, we live in an insular world where we think that people know things that they don't.
I tend to give more people the benefit of the doubt than you do.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not sure who you deal with in your daily life, but I tend to deal with smarter people who I think are culturally, you know, educated and adept.
Do you mean that
I'm going to talk to Larry Newman now, speaking of culturally adapted.
If you had said like Frank Lloyd Webber, that would have been all the difference in the world.
Frank Lloyd Webber?
Frank Lloyd Webber, yes. He designed beautiful homes on the North Shore in the shape
That's
of
right.
cats.
Yeah.
They were
yeah.
all
Frank
cats.
Frank Lloyd Webber.
And they had cat fur on them. And then the chandeliers would crash for no reason whatsoever in every one of
that
his houses.
Waiter would know that.
What's going on with you now? Now, you've got this audition that just happened, about 45 minutes ago, an hour ago, that you got the call for. And that's sometimes how things work in the acting profession. What's going on for you in the next coming months?
My next gig isn't actually until October when we start up again with Christmas Carol. So now it's like concentrating on the film stuff and seeing if I can finagle my way in as one of Chicago's usual suspects to get into something.
For our listeners here and out there in podcast world, if they were in town for the weekend at Taste and for other events, there are summer theater things happening in Chicago. Yeah. Not as many as there are during the actual season, October to May, but certainly things maybe not to be missed. What's going on? What can you tell people that they should look for and maybe just, you know, run, don't walk to see while they're here in Chicago?
I want to definitely go see the Vanya show over at
Good Vanya Morning. And Sasha and Masha and Spike.
Yeah, because I've done some Christopher Durang myself, Betty Summer Vacation, and I love his writing. A lot of people think he's a little bit dated or his stuff doesn't last very long as far as its shelf life, but I disagree. And I think there's something to be said for him attempting to put Chekhov in a different perspective for today's millennials, because I don't know how many of those people would be excited about going to see a Chekhov play. But with this production, they might actually have a good time to see that. It might open their eyes a little bit.
What's happening in Chicago that you're excited about?
Well, two things. I saw Sasha, Vanya, Sophie, Spike, Masha, whatever it's, I can never remember those four names. I saw it in New York last year, two seasons ago. It's hilarious. And one of the actresses is the character is a fairly dowdy, middle-aged woman who was invited to a costume party. So she goes as Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey and stays in character for the entire party. And a man falls in love with her. So it was lovely, and then she has to confess to him that she doesn't really have a British accent. She's an American and lives alone in a house on a pond. So it's a lovely moment. And so after the show, I went to a restaurant, and the people sitting next to me had also been at the show. And we're going on and on about how much they love the show and how entertaining it was. And I was listening to them, and they seemed very intelligent and insightful. And then finally the man looks at his wife and says, who is Maggie Smith, and what is this Downton Abbey they were talking about? It's like, you missed everything that happened in the show.
Missed all the inside jokes.
Missed all the inside jokes. What I would go to, and this is monumental, you know, we're the monumental taste of Chicago. This year, Hypocrites Theater is remounting All Our Tragic, which is a 12-hour production.
Yeah.
And Sean Graney, who's a genius, took all of the existing Greek tragedies, rewrote them, cut out everything having to do with the gods, put them in chronological order, and the play is only done on Saturdays and Sundays. You show up at the theater at 11 o'clock in the morning, and you leave at 11 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And the performance is actually 9 hours long, and there are 3 hours of breaks. And it's magnificent and monumental. And exhausting, and at the end of the show, people were weeping, and I think we were weeping just because we were so moved by what we had seen, and the dynamism and the strength, the energy that a cast that young has, that they can get through performing nonstop for, well, with some stops, for 12 hours. That it's thrilling, and that is. That is a show, that's an experience you only see in Chicago.
Yeah.
The economics of New York theater, it could never be done in New York. It's about $100, but they throw in all of your food. So it's 12 hours of entertainment and food. That would be at the very top of my list.
It's like going to the theater and to Taste of Chicago all at the same time. You get food and entertainment.
Yes. Unfortunately, all of the food is vegan. So you have to, if you want any meat, you have to walk down the street and go to the Antique Taco Restaurant.
Yes, awesome.
Yes.
Well, I think my choice for something to see, and we have tickets coming up for this, the Looking Glass Theater has mounted a production of, and you're not going to believe this, folks, Moby Dick on stage. And I'm going to read a little bit of Chris Jones's review. Chris Jones is the major theater reviewer here in Chicago for the Chicago Tribune. He says, if Ahab can't have his Moby Dick, then all his toil and sacrifices are moot. His time on the planet has no meaning. That, of course, is what Herman Melville's Great American Adventure is about, and in no small part due to a truly superb adaptation, a tightly woven yet yearning script that courses to the center of this myth's story while showing compassion for those aboard and all swimming below. David Catlin's exceptionally enjoyable and accessible show conveys all of the appeal of a life that contains actual bona fide adventure. Here it is on Michigan Avenue, an experience that does not fill your closet, but makes you think about your own white whale and when you might be able to actually be done with the massive blubber that haunts your dreams. I think that's
a good line.
That's a great line.
I'm often haunted by massive blubber.
In your dreams?
In my dreams and in my real life.
And in real life. I was going to say, in real life, I know about that. I didn't know about your dreams. That crucial emotional underpinning is what makes Catlin's Moby Dick rise to the short list of great looking glass productions of the past two decades. So if you're here at Tastes and you're wondering about something to do after you've tasted, before you've tasted, in the middle of the afternoon, or if you're just taking a day off, head on up Michigan Avenue about a mile from here. It's about a mile from here to the old water tower space and view Moby Dick. We're going to see that very soon, and I hope to have the same kind of reaction that Chris Jones had. Larry, anything else that's going on in Chicago that you want to let us know about? Your Christmas Carol this winter, always a thrill, and you're fantastic in it.
Thank you.
I know you're not getting to play Scrooge yet, but that could be in the cards in the next couple
of
years.
Who knows? That's up to Larry, big Larry.
Well, Larry Yando you're referring to. Yando, a Chicago actor, wonderful Chicago actor, who's played the role for a number of seasons now. But you're in line, I would say, on the short list of people to take his place if he and when he decides to step down from that?
I can't comment on that. But we can send a recording of this broadcast to the folks at the Goodman Theater.
It's just casting directors if you're out there listening. Hint.
Talk about your... I love the fact that you have filmed so many movies and appeared in so few. And I want you to tell the Ron Howard story. You made a movie directed by the famous Ron Howard and starring Vince Vaughn.
Yeah.
And talk about filming it and the role and your parents going to driving to the theater just to watch the coming attractions.
Well, the thing that made it so disappointing for all my family was, you know, they cast me in the role and it was a good scene. It was just me and Vince. And I'm like the bank manager and he's coming for a loan. So it was a rather longish scene. And then we went off script and Ron, who was directing it, you know, he had the little hat on and everything. It was great. And we were just having a blast. So then they ended up putting part of that scene in the movie's previews. So it's like, great, I'm in the preview. That's a good sign. The scene's in. And then a bunch of us who were from Chicago, you know, the usual suspects, we went to see the premiere here in Chicago, and the scene was not there.
And you're not in the movie?
And I'm not in the movie. But I had gotten a letter from Ron.
A personal letter from Ron Howard?
Personal letter from Ron Howard saying, you know, he was so upset that he had, but for the sake of timing, the length of the film and all that, he had to cut the scene. Every actor has one of those stories. But it was, I just wish I was able to keep a copy of the scene because it was pretty funny.
I'm sure it was.
Oh my God. But you still get royalties.
Yeah, I still get royalties. God bless.
You That's know. Fantastic.
Yeah. How does that work?
Paid, right? Yeah, I got paid. And well, they give you the money you got for the day, and then every time the movie goes to cable or gets videoed, whatever, you know, you get a little based on how much time you were there. If you work 3 weeks, then you're going to get a bigger chunk of money every time. And if you're in a very culty movie, something that's going to get played all the time, then you're making lots of money all the time.
Like Stir of Echoes.
Yeah, I still get money from that. And that was like, you know, how many years ago?
It's every once in a while. The Kevin Bacon film comes on cable. I see it.
It's a good Halloween movie.
It still holds up. Very scary.
Who did you play in Stir of Echoes?
Stir of Echoes, I was... Lenny the Crank.
Gee, that was a stretch.
Yeah, it was. It was, you know.
He was.
But sort of your ace in the hole is you play a lot of homeless people.
Yeah, you know. That's the go-to. I'm
not being mean. You've played lots of homeless people in movies.
Me and Rich Katovsky, if you know, guys know him. It's usually either Rich or me who end up getting the homeless guys, so. We're pretty comfortable with splitting it up.
Have you ever played, let's say, a husband of a married couple in a movie?
Yeah. I was actually,
amazing.
I was actually married to Jennifer Tilly.
Really?
Yeah. And we had a little, we were actually in the bed together. You know, we actually had a little scene in the bed. Yeah. She tries to kill me later, you know, but driving a car over a bridge on the south side, funnily enough. That was so weird.
This is so reflective of your life.
Yes. Every woman I know.
Find yourself in bed with a woman, and the next thing you know, they're trying to kill you.
Yeah.
You know what we haven't talked about? I can't believe this. Your big success this year, your New York stage debut.
Oh!
Larry.
Did we talk about that?
Well, not just now.
Oh, okay.
Well, you, yeah. You took the Iceman Cometh.
It was a wonderful
which
experience.
Was a brilliant production done at the Goodman Theater here
Bob
in Chicago.
Falls directed,
Bob Falls.
Nathan Lane.
With Nathan
Denny.
Lane and Brian Dennehy. And you were part of the large ensemble cast. And so successful that they decided to take it to New York. Not a move directly to Broadway, but they took it to the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Correct.
Which is in Brooklyn, obviously.
Yeah.
Beautiful theater there.
Beautiful.
A little off the beaten track, but it's out there. And you did it for, what, 3 weeks? Four weeks,
and a week of preview. It's one of those shows. It lasts 5 hours with an hour worth of intermission. It was one of those magical shows.
Well, you've had a splendid career.
Thank you.
I've known you for these many 40 years or so.
Is it really that long?
It's
no,
pretty,
not that long.
It's almost.
Almost.
It's getting there.
35. We met here at the fest.
Did I
say that? No, I'll just make that up.
We met here at the fest. Yes, in front of a donut stand.
Dickie's Donuts.
Dickie's Donuts.
Or the Beaver. It was the Beaver Donut.
Beaver Coffee and Donuts.
That's it.
Well, listen, I mentioned, speaking of married couples, I have a piece I want to read here, and then we're going to have to wrap up with our final segment. We're getting close to time. I just wanted to let you know, marriage has been in the news quite a lot these days, most specifically the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage.
Yeah.
I'm not going to address that really at this point. There's been plenty said, and we might get into that in another podcast. But I did want to mention a story that I came across. It's not necessarily about a gay couple, but George Kirby, 103 years old, and Doreen Lucky, 91 years old, became the world's oldest newlyweds this week when they tied the knot in southern England. The lovebirds met in 1988 after Kirby got divorced and Lucky became a widow. "We got on straight away," she said. "He liked the roses in my front garden." I'm not sure that that was a euphemism or not, but he did. "He was a real smooth talker," she said. Between the two of them, they have seven children, 15 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren between them. Kirby popped the question during their Valentine's Day dinner. He said, "I didn't get down on one knee because I didn't think I would have been able to get back up." 103 and 91, married in England. Lovely people. Well, I need to close today. We're getting close to our time. I need to close with a segment that we call The Kiss of Death. And it's a segment where we look at the life of someone interesting that we've noticed in an obituary somewhere. And we like the obituaries that are much more celebratory of people's lives. These are not moribund or macabre in any sort of way. Everybody had a pink flamingo on their lawns? Are you too young to have had pink flamingos on your lawn? You know what I'm talking about, though, don't you?
Yeah. You've seen the movie.
When you've seen the movie. I think we had one on our lawn when I was growing up on Knox on the South Side when I was like 4 years old. Did you have pink flamingos on your lawn?
My grandparents did.
Yeah. Don Featherstone did not invent Phoenicopterus rubra. Nature took care of that eons ago, but what Mr. Featherstone did nearly 6 decades ago, in the process indelibly altering the landscape of mid-century America, was to cast the creature in plastic and attach slender, rod-like legs for planting it in the ground. Mr. Featherstone, a sculptor who died on Monday at 79, was the inventor of the pink plastic flamingo, that flagrant totem of suburban satisfaction and, in later years, postmodern irony. He named it Phoenicopterus rubra plasticus. Less hideous than a garden gnome, more diplomatic than a lawn jockey. The plastic flamingo has been flaunted in front yards by millions, fed it in films, on television, and in song, and held up as an object of impassioned pride and equally impassioned prejudice. Mr. Featherstone had not contemplated creating an enduring emblem of kitsch in 1957, when his first flamingo sailed off the assembly line, or the next year, when the bird was brought to market. A recent art school graduate, he was simply heeding the career advice popular given to young people of the era, plastics.
Plastics.
Donald Feathers, thank you. Thank you for the reference, Clab. I appreciate that. Donald Featherstone was born on January 25th in Worcester, Massachusetts, 1936. He graduated from the School of Worcester Art Museum in 1957. And that year, to the chagrin of his professors and the gratification of his creditors, he took a job with Union Products, a maker of plastic lawn ornaments in Leominster, Massachusetts. To sculpt the first assignment, a three-dimensional duck, Mr. Featherstone went out and bought a live duck, kept it tenderly in the sink as he copied it before releasing it in a local park. His next assignment, really, he could have eaten that. He had to make duck confit.
Yeah.
Absolutely. His next assignment was a flamingo. These proved harder to come by. Working from photographs in National Geographic, he created a three-foot-high creature, typically sold as a one pair, one bird upright, the other head down as if grazing. With its insouciant stance and saturated pink promise of endless summer, Mr. Featherstone's flamingo blew his duck out of the water. An index of his novelty that first year could be found in the Sears catalog, which offered the birds for $2.76 a pair, but saw fit to include instructions. Quote, place in garden lawn to beautify landscape, unquote. An ad index years later of how deeply engraved Mr. Featherstone's creation had become could be found in the response his wife, Nancy, often got when she told people what her husband had invented. Someone did that, came the reply, as if the bird, like its flesh and blood antecedent, was a product of Darwinian evolution. To anyone even vaguely acquainted with the Featherstones, the question would have been unnecessary. In an act of connubial solidarity, they wore matching outfits handmade by Mrs. Featherstone every day from the late 1970s onward, many of them in flamingo-patterned fabrics. Mr. Featherstone's bird inflamed passions pro and con. In 2009, after a debate of 5 minutes, the Common Council, as the City Council of Madison, Wisconsin, is called, voted 15-4 to designate the pink plastic flamingo the city's official bird.
That's fantastic.
Elsewhere, however, some homeowners associations banned the creature, deeming it a despoiler of property values. But the response was far more often celebratory, as typified by the director John Waters' Pink Flamingos, the 1972 gallows comedy starring the vast drag queen Divine, or, more conventionally, Romeo and Juliet, Disney's animated feature in 2011, which features a pink flamingo character voiced by Jim Cummings, named Featherstone.
Oh,
brilliant.
Isn't that
nice,
cute?
Nice.
Yeah, those Disney people are awfully nice. For his work, Mr. Featherstone was awarded an IG prize. That's an IG prize, an annual satirical award honoring outre contributions in 1996. That year, he became the president of Union Products, serving until his retirement in 2000. He is the author, with Tom Herzog, of the 1999 photographic book, The Original Pink Flamingos, Splendor in the Grass. Finally, though Mr. Featherstone designed hundreds of lawn ornaments for Union Products over time, his wife was partial to his ostrich. I've never seen a lawn ostrich, but that would be awesome. None have exerted the cultural force of the pink flamingo. The bird may not have made him wealthy, but it made him unmistakably proud. For many years, to commemorate the date of their birth, the lawn of Mr. Featherstone's home in Fitchburg was graced with 57 examples of his best-loved creature. Don Featherstone,
dead at
79.
Wow.
Marguerite Fox wrote that. It's from the New York Times. She's one of our favorite writers of these end-of-life stories, and she always finds a way to make the life seem praiseworthy and maybe sometimes grander and bigger than the life itself was. I always enjoy those. Larry, it's been a pleasure to have you. I'm sorry you've never had a pink flamingo on your lawn, but
there's always next year.
Maybe that could be our parting gift for our guests.
Ooh,
that would be great.
It'd be fantastic parting gift.
I'd like one of them hats, though. You guys got. I see the hats you got.
Oh, you got to. You got to do something more for a fancy hat.
Are we on radio? What are we on?
It's a podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Did you give him a Xanax before we started, Roscoe?
Yes.
Roscoe, as always, a great pleasure.
Yes, yes, and I'm sorry that we're out of time, and I can't talk about, as a minister's son growing up in DeKalb, I did the only thing that you could possibly do when you're in high school is drink beer, drive around DeKalb, and steal pink flamingos off of people's lawns and put them on other people's lawns as a nice little present for the next day, which you do until you're arrested. But we'll talk about that another time.
We used to go around swatting them with baseball bats.
Wow.
That was a little meaner.
Yeah.
Well, we were tougher kids from the South Side.
Probably.
Not from DeKalb.
Yeah.
Wimps. Thieves.
Thieves.
Well, it's always a great pleasure, Roscoe. Thank you for the time, and thank you all out there. We appreciate you coming. Enjoy the rest of Taste of Chicago. We will be here again on Friday at 1:30 here in the Food for Thought tent. And we have a very, very special guest, Alpana Singh from Seven Lions Restaurant will be here. And if you want to learn more about us, go to our website, TalkSportsCast.com. It's www.TalkSportsCast.com. Thanks, everyone, for your attention. Loved seeing you here. Take care.